WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Teddy Pendergrass is one of the singers most identified with the Philly sound of the 70s. He was the lead singer for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, which had such hits as If You Don't Know Me By Now and The Love I Lost. Then he went solo, and he became the first black male singer to record 5 consecutive multi-platinum albums. In 1982, Pendergrass was in a car accident that left him a quadriplegic. He slowly returned to singing and performing. Now he has a new autobiography called Truly Blessed. Before we meet him, to set the scene, our rock historian Ed Ward has a capsule history of Philadelphia International Records, the label that Pendergrass recorded for in the 70s and early 80s. Ed says that by 1970, the black music scene in America was ripe for something new. The answer came from producers Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff in Philadelphia.
When Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff signed the deal establishing their Philadelphia International label as a division of CBS in 1970, they had the major pieces of what was to become an empire in place. Their old group, the Romeos, formed the basis for the Philadelphia International house band, MFSB, and they already had a working relationship with a studio, Sigma Sound, and its brilliant engineer, Joe Tarsia. They had startup money from CBS, and now all they needed was some hits. It took them a while, but in the summer of 1972, things went wild.
What they do? They smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers.
Backstabbers. They smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers.
Backstabbers.
All you fellas who have someone and you really care. Yeah, yeah. Then it's all.
OJ's Backstabbers was the decisive moment, a pop and soul hit that established the veteran group and Philadelphia International at the same time and gave a hint as to what Gamble and Huff were up to. Within weeks, another group that had been hanging around without much success also had the Philly magic applied to them and started their own string of hits.
All the things that we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home.
Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes had had one weakness, namely Harold Melvin. Gamble and Huff pulled Melvin's drummer, Teddy Pendergrass, out from behind his kit, and with him as the lead vocalist, the group never looked back. Next up for the treatment was a former Supper Club vocalist.
Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on. know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now.
Billy Paul's Me and Mrs. Jones showed that sexual morality had changed. Never before had there been a pop hit about adultery. By the time this run of smashes had run its course, Philadelphia International had sold 10 million singles. The OJ's Backstabbers album alone had sold 700,000 copies. What was the formula? It was complex. First, there were the big arrangements, often by Bobby Martin or Tom Bell, which really found their groove at album length. Second, of course, was the talent, all veterans of the road and able to go out and perform the hits live, or on Soul Train, for which MFSB provided the theme music. Third, as a black-owned company in a time of increasing militancy in the black radio business, Philadelphia International's promotion men had easy entree to black tastemakers and had CBS's resources behind them. And fourth, well, there was that beat.
Well, down party. You might try to do. Bad luck fella's got to hold on you. Spend money, about to lose your home. Done lost your woman and everything you own. All that is plain mistakes that chances go around. But if you want to know the truth about it, I tell you what's wrong.
Although the swishing cymbal sound wasn't the only rhythmic trick the label's arrangers had up their sleeves, it was invented and perfected by MFSB's drummer, Earl Young, and formed the basis of most early disco music. In fact, Motown only cracked the disco market in 1976 with Thelma Houston's nearly note-perfect copy of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes' Don't Leave Me This Way, which, in the embarrassment of riches, had been a mere album track for them. Ironically, part of what did Gamble and Huff in was disco. Cheaper to produce because it didn't require stars or big arrangements, it began to flood the market. Another problem was payola. Kenny Gamble was indicted for making payoffs, and CBS began to back off. But by the time Philadelphia International began to fade away in 1975, it had released dozens of classic songs, sold millions of records, and had not only started disco, but provided the template for many of today's Loverboy singers. It's something to be proud of.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He lives in Berlin. Before we meet singer Teddy Pendergrass, let's hear one of the solo recordings he made for Philadelphia International Records after he left Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is Love TKO, recorded in 1980.
Looking back over my years, I guess I shed some tears. I told myself time and time again, this time I'm gonna win. But another fight, things ain't right, I'm losing again. Takes a fool to lose twice, start all over again. Think I better let it go. Looks like another love TKO. Oh, think I better. What you think about it, girl? Oh, yeah.
Teddy Pendergrass was a soul star and romantic icon in 1982 when he had his car accident that left him quadriplegic. He writes about his life before and after the accident in his new autobiography, Truly Blessed. He was driving when the car crashed. I asked him what happened.
The car just seemed to lose control. I lost control of the car. And the car hit a rail. Therefore, hit a tree. And the rest is, as they say, history.
Do you have much of a memory of the actual accident?
Yes, I do, but I don't choose to go there. I need to get beyond it. I need to think. I don't go back. It took me years to be able to drive by the accident site. So that was the point that changed my life. That's where the old Teddy died and the new guy was born. So I don't live it. I don't discuss it. I just kind of move on.
What effect did the accident have on your voice and on your breathing, which is such an important part of singing?
Well, it has had a tremendous effect on both. At first, I wasn't even willing to try to just even see if I could sing. I just know I had lost my ability to breathe and to continue to hold a breath, and I was just really afraid to even try singing. Once I did, once I made that step in the rehab hospital at McGee Rehab, and felt comfortable that I still could hold a note and I still had a tone, then from that point on, it's been a matter of working and reinventing the way that I do what I do.
Can you give me a sense of what you do differently in terms of your singing or breathing than you did before?
First of all, I have to have something that I can grab onto that allows me to grip and therefore helps me to push, because my stomach muscles aren't the same. So it's just a process.
Well, let's hear something from your latest record. And this is a song called Don't Keep Wasting My Time. Do you want to say anything about this recording?
It's just a song, an idea that we came up with that just expresses the way a guy feels when a woman is tampering with him and not really coming straight, not really telling him what he needs to know.
This is Teddy Pendergrass.
Wait a minute, come talk to me. Girl, I've got something to say. I keep on trying to figure out, why do you do me this way? Oh, I keep trying over again. Girl, I'm still confused. There's only one thing I need to know. Tell me what you're gonna do. Don't keep wasting my time. Don't keep leading me on. If the feeling ain't there, then just leave me alone. I keep telling you I'd wish you'd make up your mind and stop wasting my time.
That's Teddy Pendergrass from his latest album. And Teddy Pendergrass has a new memoir, which is called Truly Blessed. Did you have to rethink who you were as a performer after the accident? Not just in terms of like your technical abilities as a singer, but also your image. I mean, your image had been so much of the romantic singer. I mean, the kind of sex god in a way.
Yes, that was all a part of this whole, I don't want to say transformation, adjustment. Not only did I have to worry about how do I get from the bed to the bathroom, which anyone has to worry about that has been rendered paralyzed. You have to figure out how to just survive. But I had to also worry about how do I continue doing what I do professionally, and how do I worry about what people are going to think of me, which I worried very, very much about, because image is everything in show business. It's what people see you as, what people perceive you to be, and I had to first get beyond that. And as I did, I noticed people just said, it's a combination, first of all. Some people look and they go, poor guy, I've had that happen. Then other people look and go, wow, man, you look amazing. It's amazing. It's something that you don't know until you put it in a position. My first opportunity to find out how it was perceived was at Live Aid. I needed to know exactly how my public was going to perceive me to give me a gauge to understand what I will be able to do when I'm ready, what I should not begin to think of.
My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. His new autobiography is called Truly Blessed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. His new autobiography, Truly Blessed, is about his life before and after the 1982 car accident that left him a quadriplegic. I just want to get a sense, when you perform on stage now, one of the things you used to do before the accident was, like, for instance, throw your sweaty shirt into the audience and would fight to be able to touch the shirt. And, I mean, the song, so many of the songs were about sex, about the things that, you know, that the singer would do to the woman if they could get together.
Yeah. Very few of my songs were about sex.
Well, about romantic love.
Very few.
Okay.
Most of my songs were about things of more substance, social issues, issues about spirituality, spirituals about general relationships. That is some people's image of me. What my persona is, I can't help. I was born with that.
Well, did you feel like you needed to, or that you didn't need to change that persona when you started performing after the accident?
I didn't try to or try not to. It just so happens to be that people still look at me very, very passionately. And I'm extremely ecstatic about that. It goes to show me that it's not always taking off a shirt. And what I didn't do was take off a shirt. I never did that. I took a towel.
Okay.
I would never strip down nude to my... I just don't think that's necessary. So for me to go on stage, I would go on and take off my shirt. There's a bodysuit I'd wear. So I wear the bodysuit and just do what I do. I did nothing more than what came natural. I never tried to over-accentuate anything. I always felt that if you're a sensuous person or sexy to people, you don't have to play it up. Either you are or you are not. And if you have to play it up, then you're not what you think you are. What I want people to do is just accept me as I am. Either you like it or you don't. I can't begin to try to figure out what you need or what you want me to do or how you think I should do something. I can't begin to do that. I have to do what it is I'm capable of doing. First and foremost, that is giving you the feeling, the true heart of what it is I'm trying to sing. My last performance was the play, Your Arms Too Short to Box with God. It was the most exhilarating experience I've ever had in my life.
It's a gospel musical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most exhilarating experience I've ever had in my life.
I know after the accident, you went through a very deep period of depression, and you write in your book about an experience you had with a family therapist named Dr. Dan Gottlieb, who everyone at the radio station where I work, WHYY, knows because he does a show here about families. And he also was in a car accident and is also...
Same level quadriplegia. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you said it was really useful to talk with a therapist who really understood what you were going through.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested during one of your bad depressions that you kind of stage a mock funeral.
Mm-hmm.
What did he suggest that you do? I mean, you actually did it. What was that experience?
It was, first and foremost, it was the turning point, I think, for me. My depression was because, I mean, everybody feels, no matter what your injury or your trauma is or whatever problem you have, to everyone it's all the same. Everybody feels bad or something has happened. It's terrible. But when you have gone through something as traumatic as I have and other people have like me, you have a lot of concerns about what are you going to do with your life and where's it going to go from here. Unfortunately, my drop was in front of the world. It wasn't a guy, Joe Blow, that had a car accident. This was Teddy Pendergrass, quote-unquote, sex, same thing you said, sex, and da-da-da-da-da-da, had a car accident. What's going to happen? Where is he going? It was these big questions, and I played into those questions because I was concerned about those same issues. So when people started writing those things in newspapers, like I say in my book, there's a certain reporter that really asked the question, who will be the next Teddy Pendergrass? And he named out all of these potential artist. And I read that and I went, oh my God. You know, that really, really does hurt. So the mock funeral was a turning point for me by covering myself up or being covered up with a white sheet and having friends and family come and give me their final words as though I was dead in a casket was what that's about. Because Dr. Gottlieb felt that there was nothing really he could say. I was in such a deep depression.
So what impact did it have on you when you were sitting there under the white sheet listening to everybody speaking about your life?
I wasn't ready for that. I was not ready to be in a funeral, in a casket. Dying suddenly became a non-option. Killing myself was a no-no.
Teddy Pendergrass has a new autobiography called Truly Blessed. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer Teddy Pendergrass. He first became famous in the 70s as the lead singer of the soul group Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Then he launched a solo career, becoming the first black male recording artist to have 5 consecutive multi-platinum albums. Pendergrass's new autobiography, Truly Blessed, is about his life before and after the 1982 car accident that left him a quadriplegic. After the accident, he slowly returned to performing and recording. Let's go back to the beginning of your story. You were born in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. where you still live, mm-hmm. in 1950. You sang in church when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were 10, I think it was, you thought you were called.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like?
Now, that's really weird. That's weird. I mean, to hear a voice call you in the middle of the night, a male, it calls you and you don't know where it comes from. It wakes you up. And when it woke me up, I asked my mother, did she call me? She said, no, she didn't call me. And that happened a couple times. As a result, that voice just kept calling me. And it kept telling me things like, you will do this and you will do that. And I had a little scary for a 10-year-old kid, but it was a voice that was calling me. Where that voice came from, I've never even begun to, you know, to try to figure it out. We just assumed, and we accept that in our religion as a calling to, for a spiritual calling. And I began to do what was equated to little sermons, little 10-year-old speaking sermons. But it was the weirdest thing.
What would you say when you were 10?
I don't know. I don't remember. Uh-huh. I have no recollection of what I said.
Did you think that you would grow up and be a preacher?
That is what I'm sure my mother thought I would do. And at the time, until I learned different, until I grew up, that's probably what I thought I would do as well. It's just that when you reach that ripe old age of 13, young kids, you know, they start to grow up and grow out and they get, you know, get into their own thing and start doing their own thing. And I started getting involved in music and becoming interested in what we call secular music. And I saw, got a chance to see Jackie Wilson.
You said that's the experience that really changed you.
It changed my life around, so it was...
What was it about the Jackie Wilson performance?
Just a consummate performer to me. Just my image of him was just so huge, and he was just such a taskmaster. He controlled the stage. I'd never seen anybody do it before, like him. And he just controlled that stage. His audience was in the palm of his hands. And as I say in the book, you know, the ladies ran down to the front of the stage when they thought he had fell off to hurt himself. He had just rolled off intentionally and rolled off onto the floor. And to see the ladies run through the guardrails and just lay on top of him and appear to make mad, passionate love to him in the middle of the floor at whatever time it was that morning, to me it was just, my jaws dropped. It was like, my God.
How can I do that?
Right. Yeah. That's what I wanted to.
Your mother worked in a club. She worked mm-hmm. in the kitchen of a club. Mm-hmm. And the club, well, I think Chubby Checker played there. I forget who else. But
lots of artists. Frankie Avalon, a whole lot of people.
Did that give you a sense, because I know you went with her sometimes, that performers could be accessible as well as being like Jackie Wilson, as well as being as grand as that? It was there were performers who were kind of in reach.
Well, no. To me, it was just a huge thing. I mean, I was a child, 14 years old, meeting Chubby Checker. It was like, this was an opportunity of a lifetime.
Right.
It was huge to
right.
me. It just so happened to be, as I told my kid, the kid friends I had, my mom works at a club where this one goes, that one goes. We were off limits to that. We were black working in the kitchen. So, you know what I mean? It wasn't accessible to us.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
It
yeah.
was still out of, it was just a different, it was just a different medium. One was a club where people sat and ate dinner, and those people that went in there were white. For me, at the Uptown Theater, it was black kids. So that's where I went, because that's where people were that I could relate to. I felt very out of place at Skeola's. I felt loved, and I felt that I didn't feel like because of the color of my skin was a problem, because the family there treated all of us, my mother and me, like, just like we were like their kids or their like their grandkids, like they treated their grandkids. But we weren't allowed, wasn't allowed to sit out in the hall and sit out there and hang out with everybody else. Number one, because I was underage. Number two, because I never saw any black people out there. So my mother always kept me in the kitchen with her.
You first performed professionally with a small group that you met in Atlantic City. And then you moved on from that group to perform with the Cadillacs. And the Cadillacs' big hit had been Speedo, but I think this was a period when the Cadillacs had kind of franchised, so there were several
yeah.
there were several groups singing under the name the Cadillacs.
Right, right, right.
That's
right,
happening
right.
more and more with oldies acts now. I'm wondering if anybody ever got really angry with you when they realized that this wasn't necessarily the original
They didn't get mad at me because I was a drummer. I was just a guy in the band.
All right.
I could care less.
Did they get angry, though, at the singers?
I don't know. I could care less.
Really?
It was a job. It was an opportunity to, like, begin to do what it is I wanted to do. Thank goodness I had ability to play as well as sing. So therefore, I could get a job playing until I could find a job singing.
So drums was secondary to you. What you really wanted to do is sing.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Melvin needed more backup singers, so he hired the group you were with, the Cadillacs, to be his new Blue Notes.
Mm-hmm.
So there you were, part of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. As the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
How did you start singing, even though you were hired as the drummer? Because you became the lead singer.
Yeah, that was an interesting transition. How do I explain? As the drummer, I was the only musician that Harold hired from the band, which was the band for the Cadillacs. So he took the singers, and he liked the way I played so much, he offered me a job. At the time, I said, oh, okay, more money, just another job. You know, he didn't fire me. Great, fine. We began to realize or recognize that sometimes the group would be late. If they were late, and came late, the club owners would dock them. We would all make less money. So the band began to sing the songs that the group would sing if they were late in order to make sure and ensure that we got paid. So sometimes the Blue Notes would come in and hear us singing, and I'd be sitting on the drums playing and singing. So then they realized, oh, this guy can sing. And from there, just evolved and evolved, evolved and evolved.
My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. His new autobiography is called Truly Blessed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest singer Teddy Pendergrass has a new autobiography called Truly Blessed. We're talking about the 70s when he was the lead singer of the soul group Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes was signed by Gamble and Huff, mm-hmm. Philadelphia International Records. What do you think was unique about their approach to production? And maybe another way I should put it first is, what changed about the sound of the group once you were part of Philadelphia International?
Well, I think what Kenny and Leon saw was when they came to see us at the Apollo Club in Camden, New Jersey in 1970, what they heard was a group with a lot of dimension. They saw a group with a lot of class, a lot of savvy, a lot of experience. If nothing else, Harold was a taskmaster, and he was extremely, extremely knowledgeable about show business and how we should perform, what we should look like, how you should, as a unit, how you should do things together. The choreography was like one person was dancing. I mean, we truly could work the gamut because we had to. We had to work in front of little white ladies with blue hair in Miami Beach, and we had to work in front of pimps and hustlers and prostitutes in New York or Buffalo or wherever we were. So we had to really know what we were doing in order to continue to work, because we were working because of our reputation. We had no records.
Now, how did the rhythms that they put behind you, the production style, change the feeling of the songs, the feeling of the group, and your sound as the lead singer?
I didn't have a sound. What was my sound? I was just a guy who could sing. I think Gamble and Huff gave me a sound, which is not my sound, their sound. It's the producers are the guys who offer the canvas and who paint the picture. The artist is a vehicle that's used as a subject for the painting. If I can put that into an analogy, that's what the artist is.
I want to play one of your really big hits during the Philadelphia International era with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is The Love I Lost. You say in your memoir that originally this was supposed to be a ballad, but then the tempo got picked up. What were the changes that this song went through during the production, and why did it go through them?
It's just once you're in the studio, magic happens, because you're in there with live musicians, and as you try different feels, as you try things, and that's the ability that you have with live musicians that you don't have with computers.
This is The Love I Lost, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing you.
The love I lost was a sweet love. The love I lost was complete love. The love I lost, I will never, no, never love again.
I can remember planning, hoping that you and I could make it all through, but something went wrong. We loved each other, we just couldn't get along. Take a good look at me, I'm in misery. Can't you see? The love
was a sweet love.
Yes, it was.
Love I Lost, one of the big hits of the 70s, with my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing lead. And Teddy Pendergrass has a new memoir called Truly Blessed.
Oh, that was good. I haven't heard that song in a long time.
Did your fans realize that the lead voice they were hearing was the voice of Teddy Pendergrass and not Harold Melvin? Because the group is called Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and you would assume that he was the lead singer.
Right. Well, my friends knew, but nobody else knew. And that was what really got me after a while. So a lot of times...
Do people not believe you sometimes? You say, but that's me singing lead, did they say?
Not my I didn't really tell anybody.
Oh.
I'm not one like that. But however, in clubs and places we would work, and they would say, they would come to me and go, oh, that was a great show, Harold. And I'd say, I'm not Harold, that's Harold. And people would just kind of look like, huh? You know, I guess they thought I was on dope or dog food or something because I wasn't acknowledging that I was who they just knew I was. And that was quite different. And it got to a point on our third album that I demanded that my name be put on the record. I was tired of being called Harold and I wanted my just dues.
And then eventually
I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to be recognized.
And eventually you decided to leave Harold mm-hmm. Melvin and the Blue Notes. Was that for the same reason? Just to...
No. Many, 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 many different reasons. One major reason is because of his practices, business practices, which I outline in the book. Don't want to give that away.
Okay. After you went on your own, you eventually started doing, in addition to your regular concerts, you started doing for women only shows. What was the difference between what you did on stage or what you sang in the for women only shows than the rest of your concerts?
The difference was they were probably a little more provocative. I probably played to the audience a lot more because they were all female. And subtle differences like that.
So what would you do that was different?
Played to the audience a little differently. Nothing obscene. Nothing obscene. You just give of yourself more to your audience rather than to just play with the band or just kind of get through a show. Because if you're going to do a for women only show, you have to kind of appease the women in the audience. So don't look for things that I would do, like pull my pants down or nothing like that. No, nothing like that.
What impact did it have on your ego and your personal life to be a romantic icon?
Did it have, and does it have, or did it, because it's not over?
So my impression, though, is that your ego is in a different place now than it was before. My impression, just from things that you've said, is that you felt that your ego at times was a little out of control earlier, mm-hmm. and that's no longer the case.
It was all new. All new. And when you get that kind of adulation and people are just at your beck and call and at your feet, giving you what you want. I was a young kid, 26 years old, 27 years old. 20, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can alter your thinking from it. Sometimes your head is too big to get through a door. And mine got there. I was able to, you know, bring things back into perspective, but, yeah, it can alter your ego, can give you a nice big one. I mean, at 28 years old, I mean, I was buying a 34-room mansion in Gladwin. It's kind of, you know, coming from a row house in North Philadelphia and buying my mother a home a mile and a half away and filling up a garage with Rolls Royces and Ferraris. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of people that do that.
Right.
So I guess it is kind of people that live what you call quote unquote normal life to even begin to understand that. I guess, you know, normally you work through a job and you work up and you get a raise, and the more you work, the older you get, the more money you make, and if you're able to get those kind of things, it's later on in life, not at 28 or so.
Now, I also have to ask you about the clothes of the 70s that you wore on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think people have such strong feelings about 70s fashion. They're something that are either really ridiculed or remembered with great nostalgia now, depending on which fashions you're thinking of. But what did you wear on stage back in the 70s, and how do you feel about those clothes now?
The clothes that I wore, I felt were extremely stylish because they were not rack clothes that you go in a store and buy. I created my wardrobe. I wore what I wanted to wear, and I wore what I felt like I wanted to wear and I want my image to be. It was not created by my managers. It was not someone coming saying, this is how you should look, some Italian guy saying, it was all about, this is what I want to do. So I started with jackets and pants and tank tops, and eventually I went to cowboy hats just because I had been hanging in Texas, and I had been down in Texas with some good friends, and they all wore cowboy hats, and I just decided to put mine on for an album cover and became a fashion trend. You found a lot of black men wearing cowboy hats and beards. It wasn't intentional. It's just I felt like doing it. My clothes hopefully were a combination of what I was taught being with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, which was we always wore tuxedos. I was very, very classy. Tuxedos and bow ties. Or it was something that I just wanted to create. So it was somewhere in between. Depending upon the date I did, my tailor would make something really fashionable. And I carried my tailor with me. And if I thought, well, this is what I want to wear, or he came up with a suggestion, then he would make it on the road. And he would make the girls their versions, and we'd change.
So do you still stand by the wardrobe? Can you look at your clothes from the 70s and still say, that looked good?
Yeah, I didn't wear the platform shoes and the wide shirts and all that. Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is asking for my wardrobe to be put in right now.
What are you going to give them?
Nothing, because I gave it all away.
That's too bad.
But, I mean, I look back on them with a lot of joy. I look back on pictures and I say, now, that's sharp. That was really sharp. And even today, the clothes that I may wear, it's all about what I feel. I don't ask, or I don't have anybody dress me. I dress myself.
My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. His new autobiography, Truly Blessed, is about his life before and after the 1982 car accident that left him a quadriplegic and sent him into long periods of depression. After the accident, you were using things like cocaine and mm-hmm. alcohol and cigarettes to help get you through that. That must have been really hard, not only on your body, but on the people who are closest to you, because it's... because it would be so hard on your bodies, even like the cigarettes.
Well, I was a smoker before.
Yeah, but I think the breathing is a little more complicated after your body's partially paralyzed. So I'm wondering how you got yourself out of that period. It's really hard to give up any of those three things.
All I can say really is that at some point, and I know when it occurred, I know how old I was. I was 41 years old. And at 40, I thought, this is not getting me anywhere. I really need to turn things around. Things were turning around. They weren't happening fast enough. And I needed to get away and to kind of blank things out. And I thought cocaine would help me. I was an old habit I wanted to go back to. And I got to a point where I could do it myself. I didn't have to have anybody give it to me. I could just want them to set me up, and I could do it myself so nobody else could feel like, you know, well, I'm giving this to him. I could give it to myself. And I started really just thinking about the importance in prioritizing my life and the importance of who's around me and what's around me, and started really understanding or putting into perspective what the most important thing is. And once my son, who saw me one day coming out of my studio, brushed some coke off of my top, just kind of didn't say anything, because I'd lock myself in the studio, stay there all day, just trying to get away from life. And once he did that, I said, this can't go on. At 41 years old, I said, this is going to stop. And I really need to turn it around for real. And my wife and I both decided to stop smoking. We both thought that this we don't need to do. This needs to be stopped in our lives. Or she thought she needs to be stopped in her life. And I used that as, you know, I said, well, she going to do it, I'm going to do it. She stopped. I stopped because I knew in order for me to stop smoking, I had to stop drinking. Or for me to stop drinking, I had to stop using cocaine because cocaine made me drink in order to go to sleep. And when I did cocaine, I wanted to smoke. So it was all kind of like all in the same basket. And I just stopped.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but from your memoir, I get the sense that after your accident, when you had to kind of recreate your life, that you had to kind of figure out what parts of you were like a performing persona and what parts of you were who you really were. Am I misinterpreting?
Yeah, I kind of had to put everything into the right perspective. Yeah.
So, do you feel that you think of yourself any differently now than you did before the accident in terms of like the essence of who you are?
I think that the content of my character is much different than it was. I think now that I'm much more of a whole individual than I was 16 years ago. Before, I think there were fragments. There was the work, then there was trying to make sense of my life and away from work, but a lot of it spilled over into each other. I think now I have a much more broadened life. I think my character has definitely, that level has gone up. I think I see life so much. I know I see life much different because I'm experiencing life much, much differently. But I feel good about me because of just, and I'm just not a brag, it's just that I see now that I have the audacity to move through this and make something of myself irrespective. You know what I'm saying, trying mm-hmm. to say? Rather, I'm not going to let this keep me from being the person I know I can be and that I have proven to myself that I can be. And with that, it really does make me feel that life is still enjoyable.
Teddy Pendergrass, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Teddy Pendergrass has a new autobiography called Truly Blessed.